From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This hour, we continue our series of conversations with candidates for office this election season. Early voting has begun. Election Day, of course, now 1 week away, next Tuesday. Here on the talk show, we've dedicated conversations at length with many of the candidates, including those running for judicial positions. We often hear from listeners who say they don't really know how to learn about or analyze judicial candidates' priorities or work or experience, what's relevant, or frankly, what the job entails. Yesterday, we talked with four candidates for Monroe County Court Judge. Today, we're sitting down with the candidates for State Supreme Court Judge. Three candidates are vying for two seats on the State Supreme Court. And we'll talk to two of them this hour about why they're running and what the public needs to know about the work of the State Supreme Court. I'm joined this hour in studio by Meredith Vaca, who's an assistant district attorney in the Special Victims Trial Division in the Monroe County District Attorney's Office. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And Kevin Naska is here as well. Kevin is a Monroe County Family Court Support Magistrate. Welcome. Thank you for being here as well.
Well, thank you for having us in today. I appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. We welcomed and invited Matthew Rosenbaum, also invited to join the conversation. He declined. And we thank the Monroe County Bar Association for its help in organizing these forums, these opportunities for listeners. Meredith, I'll start with you. You know, when people hear about the State Supreme Court, and they don't really know a whole lot about sort of the structure and the hierarchy of the judicial system, they may get the wrong idea. What do you think voters tend to, what are they asking you when they say, oh, you're running for State Supreme Court? What comes up?
This is a common question that I've gotten on the campaign trail, because when you hear Supreme Court, you obviously hear of, you think of our United States Supreme Court, and so this is not what we're running for. And I give them a short lesson in civics and our court system, that there's a federal system. So what we hear in the news is usually our United States Supreme Court, which is the highest court in our country, and the federal system. What we are running for is State Supreme Court, which is the highest trial level court in our state system. The State Supreme Court is a court of unlimited jurisdiction. So it hears civil and criminal cases. So very different than what people kind of naturally assume is what we're running for.
They may assume it's the highest court in New York State as well.
Yes, and it's not. So it's it's the highest trial level court. So State Supreme Court, and then we have our appellate division. Here we have the Fourth Department, and then the Court of Appeals, which is located in Albany, which is our highest court in the state system.
Kevin, what do you hear from voters?
A lot of the same thing. I spent a lot of time, again, educating voters about what the Supreme Court does. I had the benefit of actually being in Supreme Court as a principal law clerk to a Supreme Court judge for almost 13 years. So I got to see and do a lot of what the job entails as a Supreme Court justice every day. Mostly it's letting people know that this is where cases begin. Cases that are being adjudicated in the state court system that begin in Supreme Court. This is the first step. They're heard by a Supreme Court justice. They're determined by either a judge or a jury. And then from there, they can go on to be appealed to the appellate division and then subsequently to the Court of Appeals. It's a lot of education to kind of differentiate between the federal system and the state system that we
sure.
have in the state of New York.
And heard from a listener yesterday who was asking about the state Supreme Court and said, isn't that divorce court? Now, how much of the work for a state Supreme Court justice is going to be doing the work of divorce proceeding?
Well, that's certainly one of the major parts that that Supreme Court has. There's a civil part, there's a matrimonial part, and there's a criminal part. The majority of the judges that that are in Supreme Court actually do civil and or matrimonial work. So there are certainly that's certainly a significant portion of the work that gets done in Supreme Court. Generally, civil work is the vast majority of the caseload of the Supreme Court here in the 7th Judicial District. And then there's also, you know, criminal work that obviously gets done. But the majority of the justices are engaged in civil work or matrimonial work.
Okay. And Meredith, when he says civil work or matrimonial, setting aside matrimonial, what are the kinds of cases then that you would expect to come your way if you're elected to this position?
Well, as a state Supreme Court judge, as I said before, it's unlimited jurisdiction. So really anything. I mean, in addition to criminal, which is the majority of my background, matrimonial, things like foreclosures. We've heard a lot in the news about the Child Victims Act cases that have been coming out. and those are the civil suits regarding child abuse cases. Those are all in Supreme Court. So there's a lot of different kinds of cases. There's, for example, an integrated domestic violence court that's adjudicated by a state Supreme Court judge. It's a combined court that hears criminal and family court issues. So really, as a state Supreme Court justice, you should be expected to, at some point, try all different kinds of cases.
Should this be an elected position, Meredith?
You know what? There's definitely pros and cons to electing judges in the state side. And that's another thing that I talk about with people on the campaign trail. They ask, well, if you're supposed to be apolitical, then why are you running under a party and why are judges elected? It's definitely not a perfect system, but it's the system that we have. And I think the alternatives of appointing judges like in federal court, the trial level judges are appointed. There's cons with that. So I think that it is a good system right now insofar as we get to go out and meet, you know, the people that we would serve, and it's, you know, their choice as to who they elect.
Yeah, go ahead.
If
yeah.
I might, yeah.
Yeah, please.
I actually have had the opportunity of practicing in jurisdictions that did it both ways. I started off my career in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, where the judges are appointed. And there's dissatisfaction with that process as well. The process that we have in New York, while it's not perfect, it is the process that we have. I actually like the idea of the people of your district making the determination who it is that's going to serve them for the next 14 years. We have one of the longest terms. We have the longest term as judges in the Supreme Court. And again, while I don't think the process is perfect, appreciate that the voters in the district have the opportunity to determine the judges that are going to serve them for the next 14 years.
So introduce yourselves. Again, there's three candidates, two positions. We asked Matt Rosenbaum to join us. He declined. Kevin Naska and Meredith Vaca are here. Kevin, tell us about your background. Tell the listeners and voters why you think your background matters in this particular election and for this position.
I'd be happy to. I'm a practicing attorney for 28 years. I grew up in the Charlotte neighborhood of the city of Rochester. I attended Rochester City Schools right from kindergarten through 12th grade. Started off with 42 school on Lake Avenue, went to 43 school on Lyle Avenue, and graduated from Charlotte High School. From there, I went to SUNY Binghamton, where first day of classes, I met my wife, who we just celebrated our 29th anniversary on the campaign trail this past August. We have two great kids. My older son, Zach, is a second-year law student at Vanderbilt Law School. Our younger son, Alex, is a senior this year at Odyssey Academy in Greece. I'm currently a support magistrate in family court, so I'm on the bench every day hearing cases, making determinations with regard to support for children and families in cases that do directly affect children and families every day. Prior to that, as I indicated earlier, for almost 13 years, I was a principal law clerk to a Supreme Court judge, John Owens. When he moved to become the surrogate, he still maintained an active Supreme Court caseload, so I was still involved in working with him on those cases. I have been involved in the resolution or trial of thousands of cases over that period of time, and I think that that experience has prepared me for taking the bench and actually being able to take the bench and hear cases on day one of my term. The experience that I have, I have had the honor of having three retired judges publicly endorse me for this position, and all three of them are judges that I have worked with and know my work. Ed Calvaruso is the retired surrogate and a retired Supreme Court justice. Ken Fisher is a retired Supreme Court justice, and Tom Van Strydonk is a retired Supreme Court justice, and also it was the administrative judge for the entire 7th Judicial District. All three of them have worked with me, know my work well, and have taken the unprecedented step of publicly endorsing me for this position this year.
All right, and Meredith Vaca, same question.
Yes, I was born in South Korea. My twin sister and I, we are adopted. We came over to the United States when we were only 5 months old. So I grew up here. I grew up in the town of Greece in a big Italian-American family. I currently live in the Park Avenue neighborhood with my husband, who grew up in Webster. We have a daughter who is turning 2 on Saturday. And I have been practicing law going on 14 years. I've been at the district attorney's office as an assistant district attorney here in Monroe County for the past 12 years. I started out doing civil work. I was at a firm in Buffalo, then moved to Rochester, and then went to the DA's office. For the past 10 years, I've really specialized in certain kinds of cases, and those cases are child sexual and physical abuse cases and homicides. The homicides I handle involve primarily domestic violence and child fatalities. So, you know, the kinds of experiences I've had, especially dealing with the child abuse cases, you know, gives me a lot of one courtroom and trial experience. I've handled thousands of criminal cases, over 30 felony level trials, and the overwhelming majority of those have been violent felonies. You know, I can tell you that the child abuse cases are really some of the most challenging cases that come before our county and Supreme Court. So I practice in county and Supreme Court as a felony level attorney in our office. And having those kinds of experiences, working with people all across our community, doing trials, really, I think, gives me the right kind of experience to run a courtroom and be a judge and make difficult decisions.
Talking to Meredith Vaca and Kevin Naska, we always encourage our listeners to learn more online if they can. Do you have campaign websites, Meredith?
I do. Electvaca.com is my campaign website. I'm also on Facebook, Meredith Vaca for Supreme Court.
Vaca is spelled V-A-C-C-A. Kevin?
NaskaForSupremeCourt.com is our website, and on Facebook, it's Naska for Supreme Court.
So, you know, Meredith, in regards to the trials and your own record, a lot has been made about one case in particular this past summer in which a girl, a student in Webster accused a teacher, Callie Watkins, of rape. And that led to not only a lot of coverage in the media, but also a critical piece written for City Newspaper, a piece that was eventually pulled down because the author, Chris Thomas, a local attorney, has supported Matt Rosenbaum, who's running against you for this seat. But Chris raised some of his concerns about this particular case, in which the jury decided very swiftly not guilty. And according to observers like Chris Thomas, this was a case with very thin, or at least not a whole lot of supporting evidence that I think the critics were surprised the DA's office pursued it. So I know a lot of cases and a lot of claims, unfortunately, don't get pursued for a lot of different reasons. Even, let me put it this way. We know that most people who make accusations are not lying, they're not making it up. That's an important thing. But we also know that there has to be evidence in the court of law. And I know a lot of claims can't even be pursued, and that's difficult and painful. Can you speak? I guess I want to open the floor first and let you respond to some of what you heard, because I know you're probably limited in what you can say. Why don't you say as much as you can or would like to, and then we'll talk a little more specifically, and you can answer what you can answer.
Sure. So I'll just start by saying this, because I don't want it to look like I'm just trying to evade the question. But, number one, when someone's acquitted, there's a sealing order. And so I need to abide by that. I also think, you know, this is not the time or place to relitigate that case has already been litigated. But what I can tell you is that having handled specifically child sexual abuse cases for quite some time now, they are very difficult. And it is our policy as at the office that, you know, we don't, you know, just because there's no DNA evidence or medical evidence corroborating allegations by a child that they've been sexually abused, doesn't mean that we don't move forward with the prosecution. And I think that a lot of our community can understand reasons why there wouldn't be medical evidence and DNA evidence. And as you said, Evan, before, you know, most children don't lie about this. And there are a lot of reasons why. I mean, you know, they don't want to talk about this kind of thing. It's shameful. They think they're going to get in trouble. You know, all different factors play into why children wouldn't lie about something like this. As an assistant district attorney handling these kinds of cases, I meet with a child a lot. And thoroughly vet the case and determine whether I think that this should move forward or not. There's also other concerns I have about keeping our community safe, you know, when someone is maybe a teacher or a coach or whoever they are, and they're still around children, and allegations have come forward that appear to be credible, then, you know, it's my job to present a case to the grand jury, and the grand jury decides whether there should be an indictment. I can also say that as an assistant district attorney, there's a lot of information that I know about maybe a defendant, a case, background information that maybe, you know, for whatever reason, doesn't get in front of the jury. But those are all things that I take into account. So I take into account lots of different things. I take very seriously these decisions that I make.
So generally speaking, not about this specific case, have you ever heard from someone making an accusation, a child, a teenager, and you and your conclusion was, I think they're lying?
Yes. A few. Most people don't know this about our job, but there's a lot of cases that come in that I choose not to prosecute. And not necessarily because I think that they're lying, but maybe because they're not emotionally stable enough to go forward with the process. Or maybe I just question it and I'm not sure. And for me, that's not enough. You know, for me personally, I want to be sure. So yes, there's all different kinds of cases and situations where I might not go forward with a case. If I think that a child might be lying about it, then I would not go forward with a case.
Okay. And now knowing that you may not be able to answer, I'll just ask you, in this case, do you look back and think that the jury got it wrong?
You know what? I accept the jury's decision. Obviously, I was disappointed with the verdict, but I accept the jury's decision.
Do you think that the child was lying?
No.
Okay. Do you look at the alibi in this case and the timeline of events and think that it just didn't really add up that a rape could have occurred?
No. You know what? And I know that the alibi... And again, I don't want to get into the details. It's too difficult at this point right now. But I think that in the closing arguments, I really talked about, the 6 minutes that I think it could have happened. And, and if some people think that maybe it couldn't have happened then, you know, I respect their decision. And I say that I don't know what the jury's thoughts were about that. That's something that I'm not privy to. But I do not think that there was a sufficient alibi, but again, I would like to, you know, keep it at that.
Okay, no, that's fair, and I also want to respect your opponent, Kevin, who wasn't involved in that case at all. And so, to kind of wrap this up briefly, I take the point that there are things that prosecutors or anyone involved with the case, frankly, defending attorneys too, would know that the public may not know and may not find out during a trial. However, the jury can only work with what can be presented, what is admissible. And lives are at stake here. Obviously, if someone has been assaulted or victimized or raped, I mean, we're talking about justice. If someone is a teacher or someone with a job and has been accused and has not done what they are accused of, their life is at stake. If you can only present what you can present to the public, is it fair for you to say, well, there's a lot you didn't know? When the jury has to make a decision, should you have brought forward something in which you might have been limited to what could be shared in court, because that's all the jury can work with, right? I mean, it's hard to blame a jury if they don't know everything that you know.
One of the issues is always, it's not what you know, it's what you can prove.
Okay.
And that's part of what...
And Kevin, by the way, I will certainly ask your take if you want to share it in a moment here. Let's just close it with Meredith. What do you think there?
Sure. I think that there are situations where I think that there is evidence that's relevant and admissible, that I think that will come before a jury. And then in the end, a judge decides not to allow that evidence in. So that's one point. And another point is that, you know, when you're making a decision about these kinds of cases, I think you need to partially take into account a person's background. I mean, we can't look at these things in a vacuum. Yes, we consider what evidence we think will most likely come in front of a jury, absolutely. But we also look into the background and their history and other things like that. And I want to make sure that I'm being clear about this. I'm talking generally about cases, not the specific case.
Okay. And then finally on this, in our community, some leaders of color have said they view this as an example that the legal system is more aggressive in pursuing people of color despite thin evidence, and that we have a long, dark history in this country of that. Again, I know that you don't feel in this particular case that that's true, but what do you say to the people of color who've raised that concern?
So what I would say is that, yes, our criminal justice system in general, are there biases? Yes. I think that we all have biases. I think that our whole society has biases, and our court system is definitely not immune to that. So is this an important conversation for all of us to have? Absolutely.
Kevin, you want to weigh in on some of what you've heard there? Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. It's critical in the judiciary that people that appear before you feel that their cases are being handled fairly and are being handled impartially. It's also important for them to understand the process. I spend a significant portion of the time that I have with litigants in family court, and the vast majority of the litigants that appear before me are self-represented. They don't come with lawyers. And this may be the first and only time they'll ever be before the courts. They don't understand why they're there in a lot of instances. So we spend a significant amount of time explaining the process to them so that they understand the steps that are being taken, the decisions that are going to be made, and we give them the opportunity, or I give them the opportunity, to present the best case that they can put forward so that at the end of the day, even if the decision doesn't go their way, they understand what the reasoning was behind it and they feel that they've been treated fairly in the court system.
I want to ask both of you if you think high-profile cases like these should be considered by voters. Do you, Kevin? I mean, to the extent that there are high-profile cases either that you or Meredith or Matt Rosenbaum have ever been involved with, I mean, these are the kind of qualifications you think voters should be thinking about.
Well, certainly, you know, as again, we're limited by the judicial ethics rules in not being able to talk about our positions on the law and the facts,
yeah,
or on the law and politics. We are limited to what our qualifications and what our experience is. I think the voters need to look at what our qualifications are and what experience we have had in making a determination whether they believe we can be fair and impartial as jurists on the bench in Supreme Court.
Okay, Meredith?
So you're asking whether voters should take into account high-profile cases?
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think voters should take into account everything, which includes high-profile cases. Obviously, they're more aware of them since they're covered in the media a lot more. I think voters should take into account those cases and someone's entire record and history and experience.
A question from a listener named Nathan, and then we'll get Luis on the phone. Nathan asks, for people running for office who have been attorneys in various offices, how do you make the transition from, say, prosecutor to judge or attorney to judge? Can you separate the work you've done in a DA's office or in an attorney's office to do the work of a judge and do it impartially? I'll start with Meredith.
Yes. And, you know, a lot of our judges have done criminal defense work or work as a prosecutor. And when they do transition, you know, they wear a different hat. And I definitely recognize that. You know, right now, my job is to be an advocate. Specifically in my job, you know, I do advocate for children and help them that have been abused. As a judge, you wear a different hat, and you have to really recognize that, and you have to trust that the parties that appear before you are doing their job as advocates for their party. You know, I would just also say this. I do think my job in particular, you know, I consider it, I'm not a judge, but it's quasi-judicial in that, you know, my client is the people of the state of New York. So, you know, I'm advocating for a community and what's best for the community. So I am making decisions about what I think is right and just. I say that recognizing being a judge is different than being a prosecutor, absolutely. But there is an element of my job now in trying to decide what's right, that I would, you know, use that foundation to in making decisions as a judge.
Okay. Kevin?
I would respectfully disagree with one aspect that Meredith brought up there. I don't know that the role of a prosecutor is necessary. That is necessarily quasi-judicial. I mean, you are an advocate.
You are judging, or in a sense, you're making a judgment on which cases to pursue in court.
You're deciding which cases to bring, but based on the evidence that you have and whether you believe you're successful or not. You're not necessarily weighing both sides of the case to make a determination what the final outcome should be. You're making a determination whether to pursue that case or not. For me, that's not going to be a real transition because I am on the bench now. I am hearing cases. I'm hearing cases from both sides, and I'm making determinations based on the law and the facts that are presented to me in each individual case. And as I indicated earlier, for almost 13 years, I was working with a Supreme Court justice doing the exact same thing. So, you know, I will be able to take the bench on day one and start hearing cases because I've already gone through that transition and have been involved in the full and fair resolution of cases over the last 13 years.
Have you been in a courtroom, not as a judge yourself, but observing or working in a courtroom, and it struck you that the judge was not being impartial or was being unfair in any way?
I don't believe I've actually seen that in the courts that I've been involved in and with the judges that I've worked with over the last 13 years. I mean, I understand the positions that they've taken, and while it may seem to one side or the other that it wasn't being handled fairly, I understood the basis for why the decision was made, which sometimes, again, a lot of what we need to do, I think, is educate the people that appear before us why the decisions are being made. And that's the benefit of written decisions that we issue. You go through the analysis. You go through the facts that were relevant and important. And you go through the state of the law at the time and explain to the parties why it is you came out the way you came out.
Meredith, have you seen a lack of impartiality or a lack of fairness on behalf of a judge? You don't have to name names, but I'm wondering if you've seen it.
A lack of impartiality, you know, nothing explicit. I think we have really good judges in our community. Have I seen judges make decisions that I think aren't right or fair? Yes. But I would add to that that these kinds of decisions about what's fair and what's right are very difficult to make. There's very rarely a very clear, distinct right answer. I think you could put a set of circumstances in front of 10 very educated, experienced attorneys or judges and come up with different responses to those questions. So the decision of what's fair and what's impartial is not always easy to make. So while I have certainly in my time disagreed with decisions by judges, you know, I can't say that I've seen a intentional blatant act of unfairness by a judge in our community.
Okay. Let me get on the phone. This is Luis in Rochester. Go ahead, Luis.
So I had two questions. One is I wanted to know the philosophy. I believe that as a judge, you are kind of like managing the courtroom. You're the one setting up kind of the running of the courtroom. I wanted to know how do you see that if you get elected in terms of scheduling and things like that. And the second one is about have opportunities to take a step back after a year, 2 years, and really kind of audit your decisions to see about biases. Is that something that is something that you guys are, you all are planning on scheduling into your plans for the, as you become a judge?
Okay, Luis, thank you. Kevin, you want to take a crack first, especially on the first half. Maybe you're following it better than I am. I think he's asking about managing the courtroom, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, I understand the question.
Sure.
I think it's important, and this is what I try to do in my courtroom every day. Everybody wants to have the opportunity to be heard. They want to have the opportunity to make their positions known to the court. And a lot of what you do in the courtroom and what I have to do in my courtroom is just make sure people have that delineated opportunity to present their position, not have parties speaking over each other, not have parties entering into an argument, but letting them know right from the get-go, everyone will have an opportunity to speak. I am going to let you, even though I'm letting the one side speak now, I am going to let everyone have the opportunity to speak. We also, I'm also, part of that question as well, as far as scheduling, we try to handle cases as efficiently as possible in the court system. It's to everyone's benefit. I try to resolve matters using mediation and using alternative dispute resolution techniques to try and get cases resolved quickly so that people don't have to keep coming back to the courthouse. It's not an enjoyable experience to come back to the courthouse or to come to the courthouse and have to park, have to go through security, have to wait for your case to be called. So we try and resolve those quickly and try and get things scheduled to get them resolved quickly so that people don't have to keep taking time off from work, taking vacation time, or taking unpaid leave to come back to the courthouse to have their matters resolved.
Okay. And I think he's also asking about bias at the back end of that question there. Go ahead.
I think every court benefits from taking a step back on some time period basis, yearly, biannually, and taking a look at the cases and taking a look at the reasons why decisions were made and seeing if there are issues that need to be addressed there. Again, not only with biases, but with scheduling, with, is there some reason why cases are going in a certain way that's not necessarily reflective of the law and the facts in the case? And I think it's a good idea for every court to step back and take a look at that on some basis to make a determination whether there are issues that need to be addressed.
Okay, Meredith Vaca?
Yes, it's the job of a judge to run a courtroom and not only make these tough decisions that we were talking about, but really just practically schedule things and make sure that cases go smoothly and efficiently. I agree with what Kevin said, that we need to be respectful of people's time. The judges have very busy dockets, and I think that it's important for us to, recognize, hey, these people have to take off from their job. Maybe they're a single mom supporting four or five kids, and, we need to be respectful of that. So, yes, it's a judge's job to run an efficient courtroom, be respectful to all parties, and truly listen to them. I think when you give them that respect, they in turn show that respect to you. As far as the question regarding the biases, I kind of touched upon this slightly earlier, but I do agree that there are biases, implicit biases, in the court system, in our community. We all have them. So I do think that it's important for judges to show good influence as far as having your staff trained to recognize these implicit biases and just make it part of the conversation, so that you can try to counteract those biases that we all have.
One more quick question before we turn toward our only break of the hour, but let me ask Meredith first, and I'll ask both of our guests who are running for state Supreme Court. If there is implicit bias in a courtroom, how does it manifest? Once we kind of step back and you kind of get your head around it, how might it manifest in various ways?
I think that, the thing about implicit bias is that you don't always know that it's there.
Sure.
So, the way it manifests, I think, can be in small ways. Decisions that you make, maybe about, a motion or some legal issue. So it's important to recognize, that you're human, that you have these implicit biases, and try to counteract them. I mean, I think that judges need to be out in the community and working and getting to know all different kinds of people to try to counteract some of the implicit biases we have.
Okay. What do you think, Kevin?
Well, I think that's why it's important to give everyone the opportunity to be heard in the courtroom, that and to actively listen when you have people appearing before you, so that you're not making determinations based on a first impression or based on the way somebody looks when they come into your courtroom. I think it's important, and I have interactions with people across all ethnic, cultural, and economic spectrum in family court. I may have a case where both parties are earning $150,000, and then the next case that I have a mother of five who's on public assistance and a father of the children who has just lost a job. And we have to make determinations based on their respective stories. I mean, both sets of people have very different stories to tell. And I think it's important that we hear from them, and we question them, we actively listen to them, and make sure that we understand the story that they're presenting to us so that we can make a determination based on their story.
There are three candidates for state Supreme Court, two seats open. And you're hearing from Kevin Naska and Meredith Vaca, who are with us in studio this hour. Kevin is a Monroe County Family Court Support Magistrate. Meredith is an Assistant District Attorney in the Special Victims Trial Division in the Monroe County District Attorney's Office. Matthew Rosenbaum was invited to join the conversation. He is the third candidate you will see on the ballot. He declined our invitation. We appreciate the help of the Monroe County Bar Association in organizing these conversations. And after our only break of the hour, we're back to more of your questions and ours for the candidates for state Supreme Court next. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation with Jerome Wright, who has been in many ways a model citizen since his release from prison in 2009 after serving 30 years for murder. We're talking about solitary confinement, criminal justice reform, and the movement seeking to change the law in New York State. Jerome Wright in studio with us next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Meredith Vaca and Kevin Naska, they're running for state Supreme Court, and they have some similar and some different experience. And I think this is a chance to see how they view different issues that may not necessarily come up in their work if they're elected to state Supreme Court, or it may, but I'm curious to know. So Kevin, for example, if I'm reading correctly, endorsed by the Rochester Police Locust Club.
That's correct.
They're going to be on the program tomorrow talking about a police accountability board. You think there should be a police accountability board and expanded oversight for the police accountability board?
That's, I don't think that's really an issue that we can speak about to the extent that there may be cases that eventually make their way to the court system, either through the police accountability board or through other mechanisms when there are these types of cases that come up. So I don't think that's really something that we can weigh in on. It is something that is on the ballot this year as well. So it's a political issue that I don't think it's appropriate under the judicial ethics law rules for us to really to speak about.
Okay. Do you agree, Meredith?
I agree. We can't comment on that. And I've had that question posed to me several times. And my response is that we can't comment on it. I'm not trying to evade the question. But really, as a judge, we need to stay impartial. And if an issue like that did come before us, then we would need to prove that, show that we're impartial and haven't prejudged an issue at all.
Meredith, your work in special victims in the Special Victims Trial Division obviously involves children who've been victimized. And in Monroe County, the county's put forward an 8-point plan for overhauling CPS, Child Protective Services. Have you taken a look at that? You think the county's doing the right thing?
You know what? Yes, I've taken a look at it. I think that the county definitely is recognizing the Child Protective Services, the work that they do, that they have a huge caseload.
Are they overworked?
Yes. From my perspective, because obviously the work that I do, I work with Child Protective Services a lot. And yes, gosh, they are very overworked. And they have very strict time limits as far as, when they get a new case, they have to do a safety assessment very quickly. And they're dealing with really, difficult situations, volatile situations, sometimes removals of children from their homes. They have to go out to these houses. And yes, I would say Child Protective Services overworked a large caseload. So the attention that they've gotten, the help that they've gotten from the county is definitely a good thing.
Okay. How do you feel about that, Kevin?
They're incredibly dedicated individuals. Any plan that's put forward to assist them in their job, I think, is it not only benefits children in the community, it also makes it easier for them to do the quality job that they have to do to protect children here in the community.
So let me ask both of you a more overarching question about the protection of children. When we talk about CPS, when we talk about Special Victims Trial Division, we talk about the kind of work being done to identify the needs of kids who need help. Sometimes it's in divorce proceedings, which may come onto your plate in state Supreme Court. Sometimes it's in abuse cases and more. How do you think our community does in protecting kids? And from your perspective and the work you've done, Do we need to add resources? Do we need to change approach anywhere? Kevin, I'll start with you.
My experience with this most directly has been in the time that I was with Supreme Court in divorce-related matters. You have children that are usually in the middle of very protracted custody battles between parents. We have the benefit in Supreme Court of being able to appoint attorneys for the children in those cases. I would say across the board, we have a phenomenal panel of both private and publicly paid attorneys for the children in this community that do a fantastic job of protecting the rights and defending the interests of the children who don't necessarily have a direct voice in a case, a divorce case before Supreme Court. But we hear from their attorneys for the children as the advocates for their positions in these types of proceedings.
Okay. Meredith?
I do think that overall we do a good job in protecting our children, but obviously there's still, you know, room for improvement. You know, you mentioned Child Protective Services. I do think it's important to give them more resources to do their job more effectively and have the time they need to dedicate to each particular case. I also think that we need to educate people more, specifically about child sexual abuse. In my current position, I work with Bavona. It's an advocacy center for children located in One Mount Hope, and it's a really great organization. I think a lot of people probably have heard about it and know about it, and we're very lucky to have that in our county, and organizations like that reaching out to people in our community and educating all of us about child sexual abuse and child physical abuse and other things like that. Neglect is important.
Our guests are Meredith Vaca and Kevin Naska, and in a moment, I'd like to kind of allow them to tell you about a moment in their career that kind of crystallizes why they do the work they do. Maybe a moment in their legal career that kind of symbolizes why they have chosen this profession and why they are now running for the seat they're doing. I'll do that in just a moment, but I want to let our listeners know next Tuesday, of course, is Election Day. And on election night, starting at 9 p.m., WXXI will have live coverage, which you can hear here on 1370, on WRUR, and our broadcast partners, and, of course, on the WXXI mobile app all the time. So starting at 9 p.m., live coverage. There's races at the judicial level, obviously, but we've got a Monroe County District Attorney's race in which the candidates, by the way, will be here on Thursday together. You'll have Shawnee Curry Mitchell and Sandra Dorley in studio together on Thursday on this program, and we appreciate their time then, so you'll be able to examine their records then. We also had conversations with throughout the campaign season with at least in the primary season, with Adam Bello and Cheryl Donolfo. We just had Adam Bello back. Ms. Donolfo has declined an invitation to appear on this program before the election, but that, of course, is a big race that we'll be covering, and a lot more around the county and around the region. So election night, 9 p.m., right here on WXXI. Meredith Vaca, describe a moment or a case or something that has happened in your legal career that has reminded you why you do the work you do.
Sure. There is one particular case that stands out to me and will always stand out to me. I prosecuted it a few years ago. The defendant, Nike Hall, was charged with a very serious assault in the first degree of a one-year-old child. And that case went to trial in Supreme Court before Justice Renzi. And he was convicted of the top count. He's serving a sentence of 25 years. The defendant brutally assaulted a one-year-old child, causing a serious head injury where she almost died. I got to meet her. Her aunt, now mother, brought her in so I could meet her. And she was a healthy child at the time and is now never going to be able to walk or talk ever again. And moments like that definitely justify, in my mind, all this hard work that I do. This is why I do it. I do it to give children a voice and fight for justice for them, as difficult as it is. And I would add by saying, you know, that's one of the major reasons I'm running to become a judge, is because I really truly believe in our judicial system. I believe the good it can do for people. It gives people like this child a voice other people a voice, and can do really great things for all sides.
I think about the way journalists are occasionally cautioned not to allow emotion to creep too much into our work and stories, and I suspect there's occasional admonitions for prosecutors and for attorneys to do the same, but we are human beings after all. How do you view the role of emotion in sort of managing your own personal reaction? Because I can't imagine any human being meeting a one-year-old who has been brutally assaulted and nearly died and not having a visceral reaction.
I remember having that reaction, seeing her. I remember where I was standing and how I reacted to it. So yes, as humans, we're going to have those reactions. I've had that question a lot on the campaign trail after people hear about the kind of work that I do. How do you do it? How do you, you know, not take it home with you? And my answer is, you know, sometimes I do take it home with me. I find that I find a balance of, you know, having emotion because we're human, and also, you know, separating ourselves from the cases that we handle. I do think that because I've been doing these kinds of cases for a very long time, I am able to separate myself more than someone that hasn't dealt with these kinds of things. But you find a balance between, you know, having compassion for people and also being rational and logical about the evidence that you have in your case.
Kevin Naska, a moment in your career that tells you, this is why I did this.
It actually had occurred soon after the point that I took the bench in family court. I had a protracted matter that the parties had very different positions on what the issue should be or what the resolution should be in the support of their three children. And I made my ruling. I heard from everyone, made my ruling. And actually not that I necessarily ruled against a party, but the party that you would have thought based on the outcome would not have been happy with the outcome actually approached me about 3 or 4 weeks later at the public market and said, you know, I really appreciate you listening to me. Even though you didn't necessarily go my way, I felt that you treated me fairly. And I appreciated the respect that you showed me in your courtroom, and I appreciated that experience. And that made me realize that's what we have to do as jurists. We have to be respectful to people. We have to give them the opportunity to be heard, and we have to be fair and impartial in our dealings with them and in our rulings.
That's an interesting reaction, and you know, there's a lot of power on the bench to you know, you probably have a lot of leeway of what you can say in your decisions and how much you want to say. How seriously do you take that moment, that power of delivering a message and not trying to be gratuitous, I think?
I think you have to understand as a judge that the decisions that you make impact real people's lives. It's not just an academic exercise. There are real people that are going to be affected by your decisions, not only the parties, but potentially their children, potentially third parties if you're involved in some type of civil litigation. And you have to understand that this is not just an academic exercise, that there are real people behind every single one of the cases that you decide.
All right, about 45 seconds apiece. I will start with Kevin Naska. What do you want people to keep in mind when they vote? Again, knowing that a lot of voters will head to the booth, hopefully after this hour, with a different perspective and a much more broad perspective on what both of you have done in your careers. But what do you hope they keep in mind most when they consider whom to select for judge at the state Supreme Court?
Well, I'd like them to keep in mind that this race is about experience. And the two positions that are up this year are both positions that are occupied by civil court judges. And that I have 28 years of experience as a practicing attorney. I've spent almost 13 years in Supreme Court doing work with a Supreme Court justice and seeing and doing just about every aspect of the job every day. And also that I am on the bench every day now in family court hearing these types of decisions. I have a significant amount of experience over that 28 years doing civil litigation, and that this is a position that I will be able to take the bench on day one and start hearing cases. And I'm looking forward to everyone's support on Election Day. Thank you.
All right, Meredith Vaca, 45 seconds.
I would say since most of our voters haven't been in courtrooms and aren't lawyers or judges, I would like them to keep in mind when they're making their decision of who to vote for, what makes a judge really good. And I would say that the three most important things are courtroom and trial experience, having handled real trials in the courtroom. Number two, having experience dealing with people, working with people, which I've had a lot of as an assistant district attorney, talking to people from all walks of life. And number three, having experience in making these tough decisions about what's fair that we talked about earlier in the program. And that's something that I've also done for a long time.
One more time, your website?
ElectVacca.com.
And V-A-C-C-A is yes. Meredith Vacca's last name. Kevin Naska?
NaskaForSupremeCourt.com.
N-A-S-C-A is Kevin Naska's last name. They are running for State Supreme Court Judge. I almost said Monroe County Court Judge. That was yesterday. And now you've heard 2 days of conversations with the candidates that you rarely hear. And we really appreciate. Kevin, Meredith, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
All right. Much more connections coming up next.